Yes, ideally, you do want to have really high quality content. I am a huge fan of that. However, the asterisk that I'll put on it is that there are a lot of people who hesitate to ever create something or who hesitate to ever put anything out there because they often have this internal dialogue with themselves where they say, well, I don't know if my stuff is better than other people's. I mean, in fact, it's probably not. So I don't want to contribute to the noise. So I'll just do nothing. I'll just stay quiet. And I don't think that's the right answer either, because you actually don't get good until you start doing it. That's the ironic thing, right? For almost everybody, once you start, the beginning is kind of rubbish. Like, I look back at the stuff that I posted 2009, 2010, most of it's not that good. I look at it now and I'm just kind of like, eh, it's not horrible. I mean, I can spell, the grammar's fine, the points are valid. It's not terrible, but it's also not that smart. It's not that evolved. 7 years later, I look at it and I'm like, oh, this is kind of average. But it was the best I could do at the time. And I would never have gotten better if I didn't do that. And so I think to a certain extent, it does involve a leap of faith of just, being like, you know what? It's good enough. I'm just going to do it. And being willing to take those steps.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Dory, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
I am so happy to be back here. It has been too long. So let's pick up where we left off, Srini. I love
It's been 4 years since we've had you here. You've had multiple books come out, and I had the fortunate pleasure of getting to read through your most recent one. But before we get there, I want to start by asking you, where did you grow up, and what impact did where you grew up end up having on the direction that your life and your career has taken?
I grew up in Pinehurst, North Carolina, which is a very small town south of the Triangle, and it is known as the golf capital of the world, although some might claim that is not entirely true now, because we used to have the World Golf Hall of Fame, and when I was a teenager, that was brutally stripped from us and taken to some city in Florida instead. But anyway, it is a renowned golf resort, which makes for a really interesting place to grow up, because it was me and like a pack of retirees. So the short version is it motivated me very highly to get out of there as rapidly as possible.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask you, one thing that I know you've talked openly about is being gay, and I'm curious like what that experience is like growing up and also coming from such a small town environment, what impact that has had.
Yeah, the first thing is that it makes me bitterly jealous of millennials, because I'm like, why couldn't I have grown up with the internet? I would have freaking loved to have the internet, but we didn't. I did not have access to the internet until I was a junior in college, and even then, in the early days, it was not that great. Mm-hmm. It was definitely a little alienating for me, because I just felt like on so many levels that it was not the place for me. It takes a while for you to figure out you're gay, although I did pretty early. I came out to myself when I was 13, and that became a real driver for me in wanting to get out and go to a bigger place where more things were going on. But even just from the beginning, it felt so small. And the only thing we had was like primetime TV, which was, not even that much of a window. But I remember I was a huge consumer of media growing up, and just watching the shows, the TV shows about, Los Angeles or Chicago or New York or Boston, and just seeing, that was my way, even if they were – sometimes silly, frothy confections, because we were not really in the glory age of TV like we are now. It was a way of just seeing that there was a bigger world. There was a world where exciting things were happening, and I really wanted to get access to that. In terms of my sexuality, I had been out to myself for over a year before I literally met any other gay people. Which I think is kind of interesting. A lot of people, come out because maybe they met someone and they fell for them, or, maybe they are in a discussion group online or something like that, and they meet people and they kind of help them figure it out. But in a lot of ways, I had to figure it out on my own. And the only way to do that was subscribing to magazines. It was really old school. I was, I would subscribe to news magazines like The Advocate or, there was Out Magazine. So I would read those. And, I think that it also showed me, I think this is true for every high schooler in general, but for me it made it much more salient. But the handful of openly gay role models that were out there at the time, Katie Lang or the Indigo Girls or things like that, they were really like the only people that you could kind of look to. And it just made me appreciate them so much. It made me really understand the meaning and the importance of being visible for other people. And I think that more people, just, not necessarily famous musicians or whatever, but just more people in regular life need to really soak it in, that just by dint of doing what they do and being who they are, other people are watching. And you might be a kind of, micro celebrity to other people, even if it's just like kids in your life or something like that. And for them to see that you're doing something really helps enlarge their vision of what's possible. And I think that if more of us were aware of that, there's a real power in it, that maybe sometimes if we feel like, maybe we're not accomplishing all that we want to, or we're comparing ourselves to other people, it's like, you're doing your part.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you about the experience of coming out to your parents and what that was like?
Yeah, I came out to my mother pretty early on, pretty soon after I realized I was gay, because I essentially knew that I needed to. It was a strategically mandatory activity, because the only way that I was going to be able to get information, like, the magazines or whatever, The Advocate was basically like a Newsweek about gay issues, essentially. But the only way that I'd be able to get that, because, we were in a small town, we didn't even have mail delivered to us. There was like a central post office. And so my mom would get the mail at the post office. And so if I was going to be like subscribing to some magazine, she was, of course, going to be like, "What's this?" So I knew that I would have to explain things and get her buy-in. So I came out to her, and it was late one night. She had been nice enough to take me to a concert, and it was this concert up in the Triangle by a band that I really liked, and the lead singer was gay, and so I felt kind of, I guess, emboldened by that. And so after the show, I told her, and she did, I think, a really good job. She did, what the sort of standard thing that the parents are supposed to do, which is that, "I love you no matter what," which was really great and really sweet. She did sort of say the second part, which is, again, a pretty common mom thing, which is, "I just worry about you. I worry that you'll be discriminated against," and all these things. And I'm like, "Well, all right. Well, you gotta. We just have to deal with that. If that is in fact the case." But I think the big thing for us was the big moment, at least for me, was maybe a year after that. I had managed to get my first girlfriend, and I was, just head over heels for my first girlfriend. And we, my mom, the girlfriend, and me, went out for some afternoon outing. And anyway, at this place that we were at, my girlfriend and I were holding hands. And so then afterwards, after we had dropped her off, my mom, you know, says to me when we're in private, she's like, did you why were you holding hands? Did you really have to do that? You know, do you have to be so visible? You know, why are you flaunting your sexuality? You know, the magic words. And I think partly emboldened by the fact that I was, by that point, I was 14 and like right in the throes of my adolescent rebellion. So I think there was that, but also I'm actually very proud of myself in retrospect. I just was not having it. You know, some people get kind of cowed by their families, which I think is unfortunate because, you can't let people get away with these double standards. And so I didn't. I was just like, that is homophobic. And you need to adjust your attitude. if guys and girls can hold hands, you know, then I should be able to hold hands with my girlfriend. We're not doing anything different. And the train has left the station and you need to get on the train, essentially, is kind of the message that I conveyed. And I think she was so taken aback by that. But I was really firm about it. And to her credit, you know, mama did get with the program, and, you know, she's really just been a wonderful ally and, you know, a big supporter of mine in all areas since then. And I feel very fortunate because some people, of course, have really difficult situations with their family. I just officiated a wedding for the first time this year, and it was for a friend of mine and her female partner, and it was so sad, you know, because the sister of her partner didn't come to the wedding. Sister and her family just didn't show up because she didn't agree with gay marriage. And, you know, it takes a really special day, and it makes it pretty hurtful. You know, her parents were there, but the sister boycotted. So I feel very lucky that you know, I was greeted with good support. Mm-hmm.
What impacts, both positive and negative, do you think that your sexuality has had on your career?
You know, I think that there's not really A/B testing exactly. Sure. So it's hard to know for sure. Yeah. But if I were speculating, I would say that in the minus category, again, if I had to guess, I don't have evidence of this, but I would suspect that particularly for something visible, like maybe a speaking engagement or something like that, mm-hmm. I think that it is possible that some people who, you know, maybe selecting speakers or something like that, there might be a tendency for them to think, I don't know, you know, if, you know, like maybe they're not homophobic, but they might worry that other people in the audience, you know, right, might not necessarily want to be hearing from some like kind of visibly gay person up on stage. And so it would not surprise me if maybe they figured, oh, it'll just be safer, quote unquote, to pick somebody that that, you know, doesn't sort of come across as gay. Maybe that's not true. I don't know. But it would not necessarily surprise me. On the plus side, and again, I think it's interesting the way sexuality and gender breakdown. People, of course, are listening on a podcast, so they maybe don't have any idea what I look like, but I'm a little bit more kind of, you know, masculine presenting. I wear sort of, you know, men's suits and things like that. And so something that is a little bit more about gender than about sexuality, but of course they do very tightly tie together, is that, you know, you hear all the time, obviously anyone who sort of pays attention to feminism or women's issues or things like that hears that it is super common for women to feel in professional settings that they are not listened to, that, you know, it's very common to hear situations where, you know, maybe there's women in a meeting or something like that, and they'll say something and then nobody listens. And then like 3 minutes later, a guy says it and everyone's like, oh, that's so brilliant. You know, all these kinds of small negations. of course, as we're having this conversation, we're in the throes of this national paroxysm about sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. And so we're hearing how common it is, unfortunately, across a spectrum of industries that women have been just faced with a lot of things about, you know, whether it's being propositioned by their boss or having inappropriate sexualized comments in the workplace or things like that. You know, real burdens, just difficult things to deal with that are a genuine distraction from the work at hand. And, you know, God bless them, you know, these women have managed to perform really well in spite of a lot of that adversity. But one benefit that I can say to being a, you know, perhaps more masculine presenting person is that I've never felt not taken seriously. I really haven't. I feel like when I and I understand that's a privilege, and I feel very lucky about that. And I it saddens me that not everybody experiences that. But, you know, if I'm in a meeting and I say something, if I'm, you know, doing whatever, I feel like people listen. And it I think that may be because in our culture, it's maybe not so much about men or women. I think it's maybe a little bit more about masculinity and femininity. And I think that femininity, you know, no matter who's manifesting it, whether it's a guy or a girl, is kind of devalued in our culture. And so, you know, I'm in some weird ways, reaping the benefit of that, where I do feel like people treat me as competent, where people treat me as somebody who is effective, and so they listen. And also, fortunately, I have not been sexually harassed. So, you know, I don't know if that's because I'm just not necessarily what the sexual predators are looking for, or if they're worried that I would punch them. Maybe both.
This episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by Four Sigmatic. It's mushroom coffee, which might sound weird the first time you hear it, but it actually tastes amazing. It helps give you focus and a cognitive boost with none of the jitters, crash, or stomach issues that you might get from drinking regular coffee. I've been amazed by how effective it is and use it anytime I want to focus on writing, reading, or other deep work tasks for an extended period of time. The coffee is really good. It's super easy to make. You can just add one packet into 7 ounces of hot water or even mix it into your favorite smoothie. And their elixirs really work. Not surprisingly, you'll see hundreds of 5-star reviews of all of their products. And for Unmistakable Creative listeners, they're offering 15% off all orders placed on their website. Just visit foursigmatic.com/creative. Again, that's foursigmatic.com/creative.
Walk me through the earlier sort of trajectory of your career and how that has led you to doing what you're doing today.
Well, you know, I thought there were a lot of things that I thought I would do. And kind of the story of my 20s was that none of them ever worked out. But there's a great quote by Winston Churchill that says that I'm going to butcher it a little bit, but it's basically that, like, you know, the way to succeed is to jump from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm. And I think that was kind of me for a while in my 20s. I originally thought that I was going to be an academic. That was what I wanted to do. I had always done really well in school, and I loved. I loved college, you know, especially coming from this little town in North Carolina. You know, I had my sort of escape strategy was I had managed to go to college early. I had actually left high school after 9th grade, and I finagled my way into a program where I got to enter college. And so, you know, 14 to 18 was when I was in college, and I just thought it was magical. I thought it was so great. You know, I loved the courses. I loved learning. I loved the professors. I admired them so much, and I really wanted to do that. And so I thought I was going to go into academia, and because I had performed well in school, I thought, like, oh, you know, great, this is kind of a shoo-in. But it wasn't. Turns out I did not, after getting my master's degree, I did not get into any of the doctoral programs that I applied to. So it was just this, like, crazy rude awakening. I just hadn't even considered that possibility. So I had to kind of fumble around for a while to figure out what I was going to do. And ultimately, I became a reporter, which I was actually kind of proud of myself because I thought, like, oh, well, this is not, you know, good job, Dory. This is not a bad second option. You know, this is a good job where it's like, you know, you get to read, you get to write, you get to have intellectual discourse. Like, I felt pretty solid about that. And so I probably would have kept doing that, except I entered it, you know, this like terrible time in the history of newspapers, and I ended up getting laid off. And ironically, it was literally the day before September 11th, 2001. I got laid off on September 10th. And so it was just like the worst time ever to get laid off and be jobless. But could not get another newspaper job, so that career went out the window for me. I then went to work. I had been a political reporter, so the thing that I could get a job doing was being a political campaign spokesperson. So I ended up doing that for a couple of pretty high-profile races. One was a governor's race, another was a presidential race, and then both of my candidates lost. And I'm just like, give me a fucking break here. But the next thing that I did actually succeeded in giving me clarity. This was the one job that I didn't end up ignominiously leaving. I was an executive director for a bicycling advocacy nonprofit, which, you know, sounds a little random, but you know, I was all about random. I'm like, hey, why not? You know, it actually was pretty cool because it touched on a lot of things. You get to know the public health people, you get to know the environmental people, you get to know the transportation people, the urban planning people. It had a lot of cool intersections that I liked. But really what I learned in running this nonprofit was I kind of had this revelation. I'm like, oh, it's a business. And then shortly after, I had revelation number two, which was, oh, I could open my own business. And I realized it would be a lot less stressful to run my own business because I was just terrified. This nonprofit was so small and so like financially precarious. And we had three employees, and I worried about my staff. It was so stressful to me having to raise money, which I pretty much had to do single-handedly because the board was not that involved in it, unfortunately. And it was it just seemed like, oh, I could work for myself. And so that is what I started doing in 2006. And I've been self-employed since then. But that was kind of the journey to get there.
You know, the period working as a presidential campaign spokesperson, like that, the, you know, when I was looking through your bio and doing some research for this, that caught my attention. I'm curious, what did you learn during that time about communication, human behavior, and persuasion that you have applied to your work going forward?
Yeah, it was an interesting time doing press on the 2004 presidential cycle, because certain things were in play. You know, we were, of course, well into the 24-hour news cycle with cable news and all of that. The internet was definitely a factor. I was working for Howard Dean, and his campaign, in fact, was known at the time and is now sort of regarded by historians as being the first campaign to really fully harness the power of the internet, and did a lot of very innovative things. We were the first presidential campaign that had a blog, for instance. We were the first campaign to really leverage Meetup. So there were a lot of interesting innovations that were happening at that time. But also things were very different. The 2004 cycle, Facebook was just being birthed. It was, you know, just a little tiny inchoate thing at Harvard, so it was not a factor at all. Twitter hadn't been invented. YouTube hadn't been invented. All these things that we think of as being just absolutely essential to our fabric of life now just weren't even around. So it was kind of the last campaign before we crossed that precipice. But what I learned from it, it was interesting. I think that even without social media, with the blog and with the approach that we took, there's a lot of managing of perceptions. I mean, that's kind of the job of a press person. But there's been a change because you really very, very tightly controlled the brand before that. I mean, it was just everything was on lockdown, you know? And I think the 2004 election was it was kind of the place where there was a little bit of a tipping point toward what I will call more authentic communication. You know, and we were still pretty buttoned up in terms of how we handled things, but it was just starting to open up where what you came to realize was that your job was not so much to control and standardize and sanitize the message as it was to give people a way to see the candidate, to, you know, as best you could, to let them at least feel like they're getting close to the candidate. And so we tried to come up with ways to do that. And especially, I think what the Dean campaign was great at, you know, with things like the meetup and whatever, was fomenting real, genuine grassroots excitement and trying to turn a campaign into a movement. And, you know, ultimately, of course, it wasn't successful, but there were certainly moments and there were certainly glimmers of what was possible.
Mm-hmm. So how do you get from there to where you are today? You know, I know you mentioned starting a business, and, you know, how do we get to the point of entrepreneurial you, and what was really the motivation to start this, to write this book in particular?
So when I first started my business in 2006, I had planned for about a year to do it. I had wanted to lay the groundwork as strategically as I knew how, which, you know, wasn't very. I didn't really know that many people who were entrepreneurs at the time, so I was just kind of making shit up. But what I did do was I read a ton of books from the library. I mean, just like hundreds. I was taking home stacks of books, and, you know, getting them all from like interlibrary loan and whatever over the course of a year. At the time, I had a long distance girlfriend, so I, you know, we didn't see each other but like once a month because she lived in California. So I had plenty of time to be reading and studying. So I was doing that. I was taking courses. You know, I signed up for these like adult ed courses and stuff in various aspects of you know, business. And so I was trying to educate myself about it, but when I actually did start my business, when I launched it for real, I just realized there were a lot of pieces that I didn't know. You know, you just discover these gaps that you hadn't maybe predicted. And a big one was, how do you differentiate yourself? I just didn't count on A, having to be so precise in being able to somehow articulate, here's who I am, here's what I do, here's the value that I offer. I mean, of course, you know, now years into it, it's kind of self-evident, like, duh, of course you need to be able to do that. But at the time, it just felt so weird. Like, when you're an employee, you don't really have to do that. And so kind of learning how to do that was very strange and very awkward. And also just sort of seeing how other people were kind of skeptical of you a little bit. Like, if you couldn't articulate well those things, they were a little bit like, okay, you know, and just seeing the looks on their face where they're kind of like, oh, who is this, you know, sort of half-assed, unsuccessful person? and you know, knowing like, no, hey, I'm really talented, I really can do these things, but they don't know that. So you have to find a way to get that across. And then what's more, above and beyond that, once you cross that threshold, it's like, well, how are you going to really earn a living from it? Because at first, you know, the challenges that I had, number one, I was not coming out of a corporate background. I had never worked in the corporate world. So I didn't like have a bunch of colleagues back at, you know, some company that could hire me for lucrative assignments. I didn't have that at all. I had, you know, I've been a journalist, I've been a nonprofit executive director. So the people that I knew that could hire me, and God bless them, they did. But it was usually like, well, they worked at a small nonprofit, and so they could hire me for $300 or something like that. And it was a very hard way to make money. And so I became very thoughtful about that process. I really just tried to learn as much as I could. And frankly, I banged my head against a wall for a long time, just trying to figure out, like, okay, how do you do this? How do you get it to be sustainable? How do you get, you know, okay, now once you're at sustainable, how do you get it from sustainable to lucrative? And how do you do that while, you know, you to a certain extent, you have to kind of keep changing your business model, because you can't necessarily keep working with the same clients as you started out with. And so I became very thoughtful about those questions and trying to seek out answers to those questions, because they were the questions that really faced me in a very vital way. This was the future of my business. This was me being able to earn a living and bring in money. And so I became almost obsessive about finding answers for them. And so I started writing my books as essentially a way to get those answers. So my book Stand Out was about basically, how do you become a recognized expert in your field? What does it take to get to be known as a thought leader? So I interviewed a bunch of people, you know, 50 plus thought leaders that I admired, to understand exactly how they got the ideas that they became known for. Like, where did they come from? How did they get people to listen to them? How do they build a following around them, etc.? And then my most recent book, Stand Out, kind of takes that one step further, because I realized it's great to be a thought leader. It's great to be a recognized expert in your field. But especially in our current society, that actually doesn't guarantee that you're going to make money from it. You know, there's been plenty of articles, and we can all probably think of examples of people who are, you know, they might be like a big YouTube celebrity, they get millions of views, whatever, and they're not making any money. Mm. Literally, there was an article that came out by this woman who has a great, I think her name is maybe Gabby Gage. I'll have to look that up, but she does a podcast actually about money, and super interesting. But you know, she did this article, and it was, you know, talking about people who literally are YouTube stars that moonlight at Starbucks, and you know, they'll be working at Starbucks, and you know, maybe every 20th customer is like a 13-year-old, and it'll be like, oh my god, is it really you? And of course, you know, to all the older people, they're like, you know, who is this random barista? But they are celebrities in their world, but it's very hard to monetize it. And I think just for a lot of professionals, even, you know, non-YouTube stars, really hard to figure out how to monetize. And so I wanted to try to, you know, crack that code as well, and talk to people who are knowledgeable, and get real answers for myself, and apply them and share them with other people.
How can companies and organizations do unmistakable work? Well, there are a few ways, but it involves going outside the regular standard operating procedures, and that scares companies. In a culture of uniformity, it's intimidating to choose to stand out, but I really do believe that creativity is one of the most underutilized assets in most companies, and this puzzles me because creativity applied in business directly translates into innovation. Speaking is one of the few avenues where I get to share these ideas in person rather than online. Think my message might be a good fit for your event or organization? Get in touch at unmistakablecreative.com/speak. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/speaking.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, because I think that, you know, we have sort of an interesting paradox at play here, right? Because it's easier than ever before to create stuff and put it out into the world, and I think it's harder than ever before to get noticed. And you know, I think about, you know, if we started what we've built now, I don't think we would be where we are. I think it would take a very different sort of approach. And I'm curious, one, you know, what do you have to say to that? The fact that, you know, the world is so much more noisy. In my mind, that just demands a much higher standard of product from people.
Yes, yes. I think you're right. By the way, just to correct myself, Gabby Gage is actually someone I know. Ha, sorry. Hi, Gabby Gage. Forget that. Gabby Dunn. That's okay. The woman that I'm talking about, who has a podcast called Bad with Money. That's just to close the loop on that. Uh-huh. But to your question, your point, Srini, we are drowning in content. We are overwhelmed with options for content. And so yes, ideally you do want to have really high quality content. I am a huge fan of that. However, I, you know, the asterisk that I'll put on it is that there are a lot of people who hesitate to ever create something, or who hesitate to ever put anything out there, because they often have this internal dialogue with themselves where they say, well, I don't know if my stuff is better than other people's. I mean, in fact, it's probably not. So I don't want to contribute to the noise. So I'll just do nothing. I'll just stay quiet. And I don't think that's the right answer either, because you actually don't get good until you start doing it. That's the ironic thing, right? For almost everybody, once you start, the beginning is kind of rubbish. Like, I look back at the stuff that I posted 2009, 2010, most of it's not that good. I look at it now and I'm just kind of like, eh, you know, like, it's not horrible. I mean, I can spell, the grammar's fine, you know, the points are valid. It's not terrible, but it's also not that smart. It's not that evolved. 7 years later, I look at it and I'm like, oh, this is kind of average. But it was the best I could do at the time. And I would never have gotten better if I didn't do that. And so I think, to a certain extent, it does involve a leap of faith of just, you know, being like, you know what? It's good enough. I'm just gonna do it, and being willing to take those steps. So I think it's kind of a yes and, right? Mm-hmm. You do have to have great quality. I mean, that is what gets rewarded. But we have to be gentle enough with ourselves to realize that it's only through experience that you are going to be able to develop your skills, whether we're talking about writing skills or podcasting and interviewing skills or for anything. You have to leap in and just be willing to do it with a dose of humility.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you've worked with people in multiple capacities, one-on-one, in a coaching capacity. I mean, you've profiled a lot of people in this book. And I'm curious, in your experience, what is it in your mind that differentiates people who get results from your work from the ones who don't?
I think in some ways it's an easy question to answer, because it in so many ways is literally just about the consistency and the willingness to do the work, meaning, when you apply yourself with consistency, it is shocking how common and in fact so easy in some ways it is to get real results. So I'll give you two examples. One, who's somebody that I wrote about in Entrepreneurial You, and the other just from my own like executive coaching clients. So something that I found so shocking when I was writing Entrepreneurial You, as I interviewed this guy, I think you probably know him, James Clear. Mm-hmm. And James is, you know, this blogger. He's a big following, a big email list, etc. Like 400,000 people. I mean, it's enormous. And when I asked him, like, how did you do that? How did you build that? You know, to be able to speak to so many people. He said, you know what? It was like one answer: consistency. He decided at the end of 2012 that he was going to blog twice a week without fail, no matter what he did. You know, no matter where he was in the world, no matter what he was doing, Mondays and Thursdays, he was going to be blogging. And he just put that out there, and he was consistent about it. And he said that is literally the only difference, that when he looks at himself versus the trajectory of other people that he actually considers to be more talented, he said it was the consistency that enabled me to build the following and to get it out there. I think it's so simple. It's like, it's so simple. You look at it and you're like, that can't be the answer. That's ridiculous. And yet so few people do it. So that's example one. Example two is with my executive coaching that I do, and I've had, you know, a lot of people go through my program. You know, some of them have gotten really amazing success. In fact, I got a Christmas card from one of them just like a couple days ago, and I have it here on my desk. So this guy, I love him so much. His name is Ron Carucci, and he's really just wonderful and very talented. And so he was writing me this Christmas card / thank you note and talking about our work together. And he said, you certainly can't argue with the results. And he actually tallied them up for the year because he was curious. He said, I guess it's the two years that we've been working together. So he said, 52 posts in Forbes, 21 in Harvard Business Review, 61 podcasts, 10,000 Twitter followers, and two TEDx talks, a Google talk, and infinite joy. That's what he wrote. And how did he do all this in 2 years? Well, he did it. He did the work. I mean, it is a huge amount of effort to write, you know, what was it? 52 Forbes posts and 21 Harvard Business Review posts. That's a huge amount of work over 2 years, but he did it and he got them in there, and his results and his brand and his ability to influence people has been so great since then. And then I look at other people, and this is a real minority of people that I've worked with, but every once in a while, like, you get someone that just is too distractible, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, I had a guy that I was working with, and, you know, he was paying a lot of money to work with me, and, you know, as part of our 6-month coaching package, we do every other week we do these phone calls. So like 12 phone calls, and, you know, then there's a strategy session, et cetera. But with these phone calls, it's kind of like our check-in session, our homework. Like, it keeps people on track. You know, we're checking in, we're making sure they're doing things, answering questions, all of that, moving it forward. And I think maybe 4 times over our 6 months, he canceled the call. Like, at the last minute. Like, sometimes it was the night before, sometimes it was the morning of, sometimes it was like right before, because he was like too busy, or, oh, you know, I had to change my plane or something. And I mean, he's a good guy, and he did good work, and I think we were able to help him, but not as much as we would have, because he was just so all over the place. He wasn't putting in the time or putting in the work in kind of this basic sense. And I think that when you do kind of, as it were, like, put your butt in the chair and, you know, write the posts or whatever, you know, sort of do the James Clear approach, it's kind of shocking the amount of progress that you can make.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we've looked at this primarily from the perspective of entrepreneurship, but I mean, part of what really intrigued me about the work that you've done and this book in particular was, I think this is a conversation that is much larger than being about entrepreneurship, but really about the future of work. And, you know, given that we're, you know, sitting on sort of another precipice of change, kind of like social media in 2004, you know, with artificial intelligence and automation and, you know, the end, you know, for the first time in probably the history of you know, the world, the elimination of white collar jobs. What, you know, based on sort of what you've seen and you've experienced, do you think the future of work is going to look like?
Yeah, I certainly think that there's going to be much more of a continued push toward freelancing and, you know, contract employees. Part of that is that people like it, you know, having flexibility in your schedule, being able to work from home, being able to choose your clients, choose when you work. That's highly desirable to people. I mean, even something like being an Uber driver, right? Like, that's not the most lucrative thing in the world, but the people who do it love that there's not a set schedule. You can make it work to fit your life. And the same, of course, is true for, you know, more high level knowledge worker type positions. I think the other reason, perhaps the even more driving reason, well, let's say there's two more driving reasons. One is that it is cheaper for companies to have contract employees, right? If you have somebody who's on a 1099, you don't have to pay their health insurance. Like, what, you know, what company with rising costs of health insurance, companies don't really want to be doing that anymore, and so they are incented to have more people as contractors, or, you know, as brought in as consultants. And this has not been finalized. You know, as we're having this conversation, they're still in the reconciliation process. But you know, whenever it is, you know, the House and Senate have now currently passed the Republican tax bill, and President Trump is going to be signing it. So that's in process. It's not 100% clear, because they are still reconciling in two versions what precisely it's going to look like. But what seems to be the case is that the people who are going to be hit the hardest as the result of the tax bill are employees. It is thought, at least on preliminary analysis, that people are going to be doing much better if they are contractors or if they own their own business as opposed to being a typical wage earner. So if the tax structure is incenting that behavior, that is going to definitely become more common, at least in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So one other question. I realize that I should have asked you this earlier in our conversation, but you work in our educational institutions as a lecturer, so I have to, you know, ask you about what your perspective is on the current state of higher education and, you know, what the implications of that are for, you know, parents who are listening whose kids may be headed that direction soon.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I actually thought for a long time that as sort of a second career, what I might want to do is be a college president. I'm not convinced that I want to do that anymore, given the sort of paroxysms of political correctness that have been convulsing campuses over the past couple of years. I can't really cope with all the microaggression-y kind of persnicketiness that seems to be taking over. So I may not end up doing it, but I have been a very close observer of colleges and campus politics for a long time. And anyway, I am fascinated by the implications of technology and just the change that is coming. I think that for me, the clearest prediction is it's actually very similar to what I think is going to happen in the overall economy as well, which is that the winners, you know, meaning the most prestigious institutions, the people with the biggest brand, you know, the Ivy Leagues or the Ivy League analogs, are going to be fine. Because they're always fine. There is never going to not be a reason that you shouldn't go to Harvard or Stanford or what have you, because it will be a great education and it will be the most powerful brand behind you and the most powerful networking opportunity that you can possibly have. I think that there are going to be plenty of people as well who are wanting to use the I say the low end. I don't mean low in terms of quality, but I mean low end in terms of pricing. Community colleges, state colleges. I think that that's going to remain valuable for a lot of people who do want to get professional skills. I think that where we're really going to see a lot of change and disruption is in the middle, because there has been over the past, you know, 20, 30 years, just such a mantra of, you know, oh, all you need is a college degree. A college degree is so important, blah, blah, blah. And so people have been paying a lot of money for, frankly, some really shitty degrees. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been overpaying for mediocre schools. And I think that where we're going to see some major disruption is private institutions that are, especially those that are expensive, that don't have a solid brand. You know, why would you pay that much money for a diploma that doesn't impress people? You know, this is where distance education and e-learning can really become a viable alternative. I think that, you know, people are going to want degrees, they're going to want diplomas, they're going to want education. But if they're not going to an Ivy League school, then I think the next best choice is to have an education that is low cost and high quality. And I think more and more places will be doing that and attempting to do that through e-learning.
Well, this has been really fascinating and very eye-opening. So I want to finish with my final question, which is how we finish all of our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think what makes someone or something unmistakable is that they are so true to themselves that they are leaving a signature. There's a signature element. And, you know, sometimes, you know, for a singer, let's say, you know, you might not have heard the song, but you know their voice or you know that style. And the minute it comes on the radio, you just, oh, well, clearly that's a new song by, you know, whatever artist it is. And I think a goal that I have and a goal that, you know, perhaps all of us should have is to not have any daylight between who we are and how we can convey ourselves to the world, where it is it's just a clean line of transmission, so that when people see us in the world, when they see something we've written or something that we've said or how we've interacted with a person, they just say, "Yep, exactly. That is quintessential Dory. That is quintessential Srini," and that we become known as exactly the kind of people that we are and that we want to be.
Well, I think that makes a really fitting end to our conversation. Where can people learn more about you and your work and the new book?
Thank you. I appreciate it. So my new book is Entrepreneurial You. And for folks who are interested in that, or I've done more than, we were talking about this earlier, I've done more than 500 free articles over the past few years. And, you know, and they've gotten much better since I first started. So maybe don't start at the bottom, you know, in 2009. Start at the top. I think they're pretty good now. But more than 500 free articles for places like Forbes and the Harvard Business Review and things like that. And you can access all of them for free at my website, which is doryclark.com, DoreClark. ARK.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.